This is episode 74 of Our Modern Heritage, the Home and Family Culture Podcast. I'm your host, Jody Chafee. In this episode, I had an awesome discussion with Kaylin Sherwood, a licensed and certified social worker. And you'll hear in her bio all of her wonderful experience. But we had talked about so many amazing things about how to talk about difficult subjects with our children, how parents can monitor our own reactions when our kids bring up these important topics, and how to mentor our children through these challenging situations. So this is just so chock full of so much value, and Kaylin is so wise and offered so much amazing, amazing advice and tips on mental health and relationships. But this episode is only half of the discussion. So after the episode ended, I kept recording, and Kaylin and I had an amazing conversation for another hour after this episode ended. And you can get access to that episode if you go to www.ourmodernheritage.com/episode074, and that's the number 074. Again, that's www.ourmodernheritage.com/episode074, and you can access the full hour, and it's a video of Kaylin and I's our conversation, and so you get to actually see our beautiful faces and interacting and having this conversation, or you can also have access to the full audio. So make sure you go check out that URL so you can subscribe to get access to the full discussion. If you find this episode valuable at all, I know that you're going to find the whole conversation incredibly valuable. We went into even more detail about mentoring, about how to be more process-oriented, how to establish more of a goal-oriented mindset and narrative in your family without destroying our individuality. So there's just so much value in this whole conversation, and I'm so excited to share it with you. So make sure you go to that URL at www.ourmodernheritage.com/episode074. Enjoy this awesome episode. So I have Kaylin Sherwood on the show today. Kaylin is a licensed clinical social worker with a master's degree in social work from the University of Washington in Seattle. She has a background of working with youth and their families as an intervention specialist, serving as a clinician and an assistant dean to a boarding school for high-risk youth. And as a professor of social work at Longwood University. She is currently working as a school social worker in three schools in the Chesterfield County Public School System and as an adjunct professor at Longwood University. So welcome, Kaylin.
Thanks.
So happy to have you. I'm so excited. So
I'm
go to church.
To do this
too. I go to church with Kaylin, and she gave this awesome presentation about how to talk about the difficult things that we need to talk about with our kids, especially mental health and suicide, or, you know, things like that, depression. And so I felt like that was a really important topic to be able to discuss when it, involves our family culture, because I think that when we can have these kinds of conversations, or we can learn how to discuss our big feelings, then that can really help to create a safe environment for our family culture to take shape. So I'm really excited to talk with you today, Kaylin.
Good. I'm excited too.
So go ahead and start out telling us about what your presentation involved.
It just depends on different families what the difficult topic is. And I think the biggest concern with family culture for sure is that you're having the conversations long before the issue arises. You want there already to be a sense of what's okay to talk about and what's not okay, and how we bring things up and how we talk about things appropriately. And so it's really hard. When I was presenting this, there were obviously women, it was at a women's conference. There were women who were, you know, thinking about family members and friends that were in a lot of different situations. So one of the first things that I just said is, you know, we sort of just pondered that question, what makes it so difficult to bring up a difficult topic? And that really is that we can only control ourselves and we can't control other people. So we get super nervous and scared of how other people are going to react. And definitely with younger kids, we worry about bringing up touchy subjects because we don't want to introduce something that they're like, hey, that's a good idea, so we want to make it okay, or introduce something that they're not necessarily mature enough to manage the topic and content themselves as well. So I think we just have a lot of fears about how it can spiral out of control. And I always think, whenever I work with families, that the most important thing that you can do is just really focus on the fact that the only thing that you can control is yourself, is your own reaction and your own preparation, and your own baggage.
Can I interject something really just really quickly where you said that the fear that we mm-hmm. have to talk about these kinds of things with our kids. And I can definitely see that because with my oldest who's 9, she is really tall for her age. She's really kind of, she's not chubby or anything. She's just a big kid. She's large for her age. Yeah. And, you know, I wanted to get her one of these like girl body books, you know, or like, you know, to teach these girls like what to do, how to take care of their bodies.
Right.
But in one of them, it has this whole big chunk about body image mm-hmm. that was just like, I felt like if she were to read that, it would actually put the idea of being afraid of body image into her mind.
Right.
That, you know, it's like what you were saying. Like if we bring up, oh, kids stress about these different things, then they're mm-hmm. going to go, oh, what is that? Should I be stressing about that? You know?
Right.
and I feel that I've almost tried to like avoid even the topic of her worrying about her body right. image, because I just feel like for me, I just talk about, let's just talk about our bodies being strong. Let's just talk about our bodies being a gift. Let's just talk about, you know, trying to take good care of our bodies to keep them healthy and clean. And so, it's that to me is how I approach that topic, is trying to address like a healthy attitude around like body image. And then, you know, and seeing, you know, maybe there's ways that can translate to other,
mental health issues. And I think if you're already bringing that topic up and she knows it's an okay topic to talk about, then a lot of times she'll let you know when she needs to have more of a conversation about it being a bigger concern, you know, that mm-hmm. she's starting to worry about things. So, you know, a lot of times that is exactly what we're looking for, is making sure that we've sort of laid the foundation. So when it does become a little bumpy, they know that they can talk about it, but we don't need to create worry about something that they're not worried about yet, because we're worried that they might be worried. And then, it's just a snowball.
So when those topics do come up, you know, what is the fear? What is the fear when the kids do bring them up? What are parents so afraid of?
Well, I think that it's a whole wide range, you know, like I was saying before, it's a range of that we would introduce them to something, or that we'll say something wrong that will make them mad, that will ruin the relationship. I think there's just a lot of fear of failure. There's fear that it's going to go badly and that it will, ruin the relationship, when that's sort of ridiculous, because none of our relationships are stagnant. You know, they don't just stay the same. So even if we hit a bumpy stretch, then typically, unless it's really sort of built up, then eventually some relationships end. But most of the time, that's what it's like to be in a family. That's what it's like to have friends. That's what it's like to be human, is to sort of bump into people and then figure out how to do a better job.
So how do we work on this ability to, you know, address the issues and be open to the natural progression of how the relationship may unfold? Or, you know, I think that it comes back to, like you said, the way that we gauge the situation, mm-hmm. how we model the behavior and choose our reactions.
Right. Because a lot of times when I'm getting anxious or worried about anything that's going on, it's really helpful for me to just sort of step back and say, okay, what do I actually have control over? And then those are the only things that are worth worrying about, because the other things are going to happen, or they're not, on their own. And me losing sleep over it isn't going to change that. So I really feel like the only place to put energy into it is to be more self-reflective and make sure that I'm focusing on the things that I have control over. So And a lot of these are really, I just need a footnote myself, cite my sources. I am quoting lots of really bright, great people who, you know, I think when we do a great job, we steal great things from other people and we take them in. So none of these are unique to myself. If I sound smart, it's probably because I'm quoting somebody else. But I was introduced to this idea of a pendulum. And usually when I share this with kids, I draw it on a board and then my artistry is not the best, but they usually figure out that it's just like that pendulum in the middle of a grandfather clock. I introduce the pendulum either to kids or to parents, and this idea that the pendulum is going to be swinging on two sides. It's going to swing without getting all physics and caught up in friction and gravity and whatever. Generally, we're going to go with, in simple terms, it's going to swing as high on the left side as it's going to swing on the right. Usually when we draw it, we I take the time with kids or parents, whoever I'm talking to, and on one side, we'll list all the emotions that we can tie to that we think of as more of the sad or unhappy, less pleasant feelings. And so they're going to list things like grief and loneliness and embarrassment and shame, just all those things that we can really be worried about. Yeah. And then on the other side, we're going to list things like feeling loved and satisfaction and being included and being excited and just all those great and happy, enjoyable feelings. And then we look at the way that the pendulum swings and usually talk about how when we're kids, when we're younger, that pendulum swings just full board wide open. And, you take a kid to get ice cream and they're full scale happy. They are thrilled. Could not be a better day. They're getting ice cream. And that ice cream, then take a couple licks, it falls, it hits the sidewalk and they are in full scale devastation. Worst case scenario ever. They're just destroyed. And then, you take them back in and get another scoop and they're right back to a good place. And so we can watch that with younger kids, how that swing goes just as wide as that pendulum can swing. They don't feel any pressure to change how they're doing that. And then as we get older, we have events or we get messages from people around us that certain things are not okay. And typically they're associated with things that are really painful for us. Yeah. Are pretty uncomfortable. So if you think of a very simple explanation is grief. We really love someone and that person leaves or dies. They're no longer with us. And that just feels absolutely devastating. It is just crushing and it's hard to figure out how to feel better. And it feels like it's never going to feel better. And so sometimes what we'll do is we'll sort of put a block in where that pendulum can swing and so that it doesn't swing up as high anymore. Because if I swing all the way up again, it's going to feel that devastating again. And I never want to feel that bad again. And so we make up silly rules for ourselves. They don't seem silly. They seem perfectly rational in our adult brains, but we decide things like I don't do funerals or I don't cry or things like that. But a lot of times those things have happened much sooner to us as kids. Mm-hmm. Have had, maybe there's a divorce in the family or there is a death or there's just a message that like you need to do better. And so kids start putting these different blocks in and we start to say things like boys don't cry and walk it off and girls just need to sit pretty and things like that where we're just not allowed to be in our emotions because boys are supposed to be tough and girls aren't supposed to be hysterical. I know I'm oversimplifying that, but
right.
We end up putting in all these blocks, and so that pendulum is swinging less and less. And what we have inadvertently done while we were protecting ourselves and trying to control our life and all those things that seem very rational, we have inadvertently put blocks on the other side of that pendulum swing. And so now we have less access to the happy, joyful, good feelings, the things that are enjoyable. And so now I have less access to feeling satisfied, less access to my peace, less access to feeling fully and truly loved. And then we start to do things ourselves as we're in teenage mode and, you know, we want to fit in. So we do things to sell out and be cool and whatever. A lot of times those things can bring some shame. So sometimes those events that put blocks in can be things that happen to us. But then a lot of those we sort of embrace afterwards and put them in ourselves. And when I talk to people about this and we draw this out on a chalkboard or wherever drawing it, a lot of times they want to put depression on that sad side. And a lot of times I make them hold off and we wait until that pendulum has so many blocks that it's just sitting at the bottom and no longer has a swing to it. And talk about how depression really is there. When you talk to people that truly are experiencing depression, they don't say that they feel sad. They say they feel nothing. Yeah. They feel numb. They don't really feel like they're alive. So if we take this whole image and go back to the idea of how do I talk to my kids or my friends or whoever it is, I'm going to think about what is my baggage, what are my blocks, what am I worried about because of things that happened to me, and make sure that I'm making them mine and not whoever I'm talking to making it their baggage. I'm not assuming that my worries should be the same as their worries. And also, I think that really mental health is about taking charge over those blocks. How do I remove those blocks? And then we have a whole nother line of questioning that we could go into about how you do that. And that can certainly be through a lot of different ways. It could be very simply, you need to get a really good therapist who pushes you to be uncomfortable and do the things that you need to do to take it on. But it can also be things that we as individuals learn are good for us. And it can be things like journaling and meditation, and it can even be things like exercise. You know, lots of people say that running, and I ride bikes for hours, and people think, wow, that is crazy. Aren't you so bored? And I'm like, no, actually, my friends will tell me, have you ridden this week? Because I can tell that you have it because you're just more grumpy. Right. So, finding those things that help us take charge back over those blocks, and most especially learning that the events that happened to us are not happening anymore. So we're preparing for this thing that is in the past and it's not our future. We have to find a way to put it back in the past and leave it there and figure out how to just open that pendulum back up for ourselves, take away some of those rules and limitations that we have built in so that we do have the risk and the absolute promise that we are going to experience pain and we are going to suffer and we're going to experience things that are unpleasant. But most especially, I love the idea of this pendulum because we can challenge the idea that any of those feelings that you might be experiencing on the sad side, that instead we want to label those as bad and the happy feelings as good. And we really have to take that sort of stigma out of it because life is full of the highs and the lows. And living a full life and experiencing our full life is about experiencing both of those. And when we block out the ones that are more uncomfortable, because certainly the sad feelings are more uncomfortable, right. And the other side is much more comfortable. We would much rather feel peace and happy and love. We want to enjoy those things. And we have to take the stigma out against ourselves where we think that if I'm feeling lonely, if I'm feeling sad, if I'm feeling these things that are uncomfortable, that I am bad. That everybody else that I see on social media who's, you know, always posting happy pictures and everything looks picture perfect, that they're an actual better person.
Right.
And that's not true. We tend to only post extremes on social media, and those are rarely accurate to everyday life.
Right.
Our life is mostly everywhere in between of the highs and lows that get posted on social media.
So there's a few things that I hear you saying in all of that. Is that number one, when we want to address our issues, we have to start as parents. It really has to come back to what is our baggage, what is our blockages in our psychological development and our pendulum.
Right.
Because a lot of times when our kids start to feel big feelings, it's more that we are triggered by wanting to avoid those big feelings.
Yeah. Right?
So that's the, yeah. Go ahead.
Well, and if you even think about your own parent, like if you want to go out this weekend, which parent would you ask? Would you ask your mom or your dad? Right. Because we already know based on just the personality, well, no, mom's going to remember that I got a D on my math quiz and she's going to remember. So we don't ask mom. We ask dad, who's like, sure, sounds cool. Do you need 10 bucks? You know, like we remember which one of our parents is the one that, you know, is good. So it gets obviously more complicated when we talk about issues that need to be brought up, but we would think about, have we made ourselves the person that someone is going to come talk to me when something's going on. And that is going to be based on, have you taken care of your own baggage? I definitely have people in my life that if I have something difficult going on, that is not the person, because they'll make it about them. They'll be so upset over it. And it's just right. Like those are not the people, because they are still like, they're still just drowning. And they're still really pinned in from their own sort of struggles that they haven't gotten to a place where they're still in, the blocks are in control of them. They're not in control of their blocks and baggage yet.
Yeah. And so it's like if we can be almost less reactive and allow space for our kids to feel those things, because that was my question as you were talking. I was like, so I have a kid who's super reactive and he gets really upset. And so how do I just sit back, or how do I coach him through, you know, it was like scary to think I have to just sit back and witness my kid experience this extreme emotion. Is that basically what you're saying?
Yes. Well, I think that some of it is, you know, it's obviously about setting boundaries and it's about setting the structure. One of the things that I detest the most is in schools, in families, in friendships, wherever. I don't care what the location is, but I hate when people say, this is a safe space. So go ahead and just tell me whatever you need to tell me. This is a safe space. And, you know, you can put a beanbag chair there and you can even put a little title over it. That doesn't make it a safe space. The thing that's going to make it safe, a safe space, obviously, is by the things that you have done to show and create. And that doesn't happen by a one-time declaration. So as parents, we can't just say, if you have anything you need to tell me, you can always come to me. Okay, I'm pretty sure every parent since the beginning of time has probably used that line, but I have a lot of evidence based on my whole career saying there's a lot of parents who didn't really back that up. And so it's really about the consistency. And a lot of times if you're trying to change those things, you also have to understand that your kids at first are not going to believe you. They're used to whatever you have been doing up until that point. So if you start doing something new, it's sort of like how we think of everybody with their New Year resolution, right? Your New Year's resolution is something that's maybe going to last 2 weeks. And then we know by week three, we can go back to the same old game, the way that we were pushing moms and buttons before, the same way we manipulated dad, whatever, we can go back to that. So it really is going to be about consistency, knowing that every single time, that is how it's going to be. So your kids are going to push at first because they don't believe you. They think that you're just, I don't know, you read some really exciting book and it's going to be short term.
I read an article that says.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. Well, and that's something too that I just think about these things a lot, because I'm trying to, I'm actually creating like a course about how to, you know, develop effective constructive coping mechanisms. Right. And it really comes back to that, like our ability to cope with the extremes of the pendulum, or even and to recover from those things. Like, because what you said, when you said that the pendulum will always swing the equal amount the other way, right? And I think that a lot of times we experience those extremes on one side and we don't give ourselves opportunity to swing the other way.
Oh yeah.
You know, it just takes this, the same amount of trauma that you experience, it takes the same amount of recovery time and space.
Right. Well, and I think it takes some faith that it is going to swing back the other way. And I think that's also another place where our gratitude really comes, because a lot of times we tend to highlight and hold on to the negative mm-hmm. things. You know, there's actually lots of research to show us that our brains, I mean, we can all sit around and war story. Oh, you know, when I was a kid, things were so much harder, blah, blah, blah. We always want to tell the really hard things. Mm. We go camping and we'll tell you the story about when the tent got flooded, but we won't necessarily tell you the 97% of the rest of it that was sunny and beautiful and fun. And so our brains just sort of get focused on that. And so I think places where we can be more mindful of the whole experience, we can hold on to some of those positive moments by using gratitude in really positive ways. It helps us to realize that there are just more lovely things going on in our life than we're necessarily paying attention to.
Well, and there's a couple of ways that I've seen in my life how I've been able to cope with that is the negative things is because I don't want to not tell the stories of how I was able to overcome.
Oh, absolutely. You
know, I think that that's another way that we teach resilience is
right.
But overcoming comes from being able to look for opportunity in those negative experiences to learn or to grow or, you know, just embrace even the feelings that you feel. Because I think sometimes when we teach our kids to ignore or to push down or, you know, just glaze over or sugarcoat those things. And we're telling them those feelings are bad. And we're continuing perpetuating that narrative that the label that those things are bad. And so that's one of the ways. And then that I cope with it. And then you mentioned also channeling those negative feelings into things that are constructive. Mm-hmm. And doing things like doing bike riding, doing art, doing music, exercising, you know, different things. Those are ways that have allowed me to like cope with those negative feelings. And it's not to ignore the negative feelings. It's just to give yourself space to recover and to...
Right.
To
embrace, and your kids are paying attention. Your kids are totally paying attention. And so it's another one of those moments where it's... we actually have to do what we say, not just, you know, say we're going to do it. Because I think any of us can usually give those right answers. We can say, oh yeah, I should exercise. Have your kids ever seen you exercise? Like, right. Have they ever seen you? Like, how do they see you cope? You know, when you lose your job, how do they see you cope? Do they see you manage with anger? Do they see you manage with ice cream? How do they see you cope? And I think that that's the most important thing for us to really be reflective on is nobody wants to be preached to, you know, nobody wants to be told like, well, you know, back in my day or any of those things, like we just don't want to hear the preachiness because truthfully, most of us know better. And so it's really just a matter of making sure that we're doing those things and then we're doing them consistently so that, you know, that is really the thing that gets passed on. Our kids are going to remember that they're absolutely paying attention. And, you know, if it's something that you celebrate, then it's going to be, you know, oh, well, I've had a rough week, so I deserve to do nothing this weekend. They're going to learn that that's what they do on the weekend too, that instead mm-hmm. of it being a family time sort of moment for them, that instead they get to sort of just selfishly, I'm just going to have a me weekend and you kids fend for yourselves or whatever, whatever the message might be. We can't just say it. It's just like declaring a safe space. It actually has to be followed through with the actual actions. Because obviously actions speak louder than words. That's really going to be what has the strongest message.
Right. So we have to model those mm-hmm. those behaviors is what I hear you saying.
Yeah.
And before we started recording, you brought up an article about a study of how teaching kids how to cope. Can you tell us about that study?
Yeah. One of my coworkers just shared this and they just did a study in at Yale. And I think they said it was a 4-year study. And they took half of the kids and the study was about adolescents with anxiety. They took half of those kids and they did what is well known to be the best treatment. They did cognitive behavioral therapy and helped them recognize when they had their thoughts coming up and develop some coping strategies to deal with that. And then they took the other half of the kids and actually had each one of those kids had to have at least one parent participate in the training. And so really in this situation, the parents are the ones that got the therapy. Not that it was specifically therapy, but in the same way, It helped them to realize some of the things that they were doing to help accommodate their kids because they had anxiety was actually increasing it. And so helping the kids identify things that, okay, this is in a very loving and gentle way, say, this isn't really okay. Like, we can't keep doing the, you know, this thing where you're texting me 45 times during the school day, or, you know, I have to sleep in your bed for you to fall asleep, or just any of those things that just become crippling to a kid, sort of tailoring those back. And so what they found is that for years, we've only used medication and CBT for anxiety, and that these adolescents who had their parents get trained, that was more powerful. And really, I think what the way they end the article, and definitely what in my own therapeutic practice would take on, is a little bit of both. We work with the kids to develop their own coping strategies, but also help the parents also be developing coping strategies and helping them build a structure for their kids so that they are learning to manage their own symptoms and identifying those and building their own coping. And I do think that a lot of times parents don't necessarily know what great coping strategies are, so they just send the kid into therapy. But that isn't usually, if there's somebody that has a struggle, then the best way to manage that is to have the whole family sort of involved in it.
So I love that so much, because what I hear you saying with this study was that by teaching the parents, it became more effective because there was almost like a team effort in a way, or, right. You know, and in a TED talk that I listened to recently, and I have shared it on this podcast before, it talked about some of the coping strategies, and in a study of kids who are dealing with, you know, fear of failure, pressure to perform, one of the things that they need is a non-judgmental, non-parental adult to mentor them. And I shared that in an article, and somebody responded like, no, it really should be their parents. And I was just like, you know, that would be ideal, because mm-hmm. parents really should be the first mentor to our children. And we are, right. you know,
right.
But I think as the kids get older and they start experiencing these big emotions, I think mm-hmm. that parents tend to judge. And they become more self-invested in the outcome of what their kids are experiencing.
Well, they have so much more, you know, concern, and they're looking down the road for their kids. And so they definitely are more caught up emotionally in the outcome and the failures and successes of their kids. I think it's another place for us definitely to be paying attention, because I think it's another place that it's one of our blocks.
Yes, exactly.
But I do think that if you also just pay attention to kids in their developmental stages. Adolescence is just a time to, I had a psychologist friend who he used to talk about, like, back in the caveman days. So he would always say cave, and he's like, adolescence is a time for them to get out of the cave and go explore the world.
Right.
And so I think that is true, even though we don't live in caves anymore. I think that's true as well. And I think that, There's a lot of research out there to really show that adolescents who have sort of a mentoring figure in their life, as well as parents, that is sort of the prime
ideal
spot that you can have your kids in. And a lot of times that will come through your community. That will come through your church community. That will come through, it could be through sports. It could be a really great coach. It could be a lot of different people, their leaders in their youth group, different things like that. But it can be really impactful, because sometimes, you know, parents are not always on their A game, and they haven't always taken care of all of their own mental health things or their own concerns, things like that. And so you know that if I ask this question to my mom, she would totally freak out. I feel like, right. I hear that a million times from adolescents. Like, right. they have a question and they're going to ask me, and I'm like, well, thank goodness they're at least asking me, because I don't want them to just look it up on the internet or find out on right. the back of the bus. Like, we want them right. to actually ask a responsible adult. So kids are going to ask those questions. They're naturally curious. They're also naturally looking for entertainment and excitement, and nothing could be more boring than parents when you're a teenager. So they don't want to ask you that stuff, because you're boring. And so it's a really, I love, actually, I will get super geeked out if we have a conversation about mentoring too, because I think it's really powerful. There's another cool study. I know they're following teenage kids in the foster care system, and the best chance that they have at success when they age out of the foster care system is if they have had a strong mentor in there. Even if they lived in a foster like group home, they weren't even necessarily in a family home. Just powerful stuff that comes. I think that's from UPenn, where they're following these kids that are getting mentors, and how just having somebody cheering for you, just knowing that there's an adult that thinks you're super cool and somebody's cheering for you, makes a huge impact. And sometimes parents can't do it. Sometimes parents can, but even better when you have a whole crowd of people cheering
for
you.
Yeah. I love that. I love that so much. Well, because that's something that I've definitely talked about on this. And part of my message is like trying to create some environment for your child that's non-judgmental, you know, and, but parents, I think that we get so caught up. And the reason why we get so reactive when our kids have big feelings is because we're judging, and that judgment turns into shame. Because, you know, we're telling them that it's not okay to feel.
Right.
And so then they go, oh, then I must be bad. And that's a, that to me is a big issue. Like shame culture is a big deal. And, and it's definitely something that I wanted to advocate for avoiding in our home and our family culture. And so how do we avoid the shame culture?
So I have this really great therapist that I work with, and, at the boarding school that I worked at, he would teach this to the very first parent conference when the parents would come in, and he would have a conversation with them about the difference between process and outcome orientation. And so he talked about how when we're little kids, we're playing soccer, and you know, you look, there's like two kids over there, like playing with a butterfly. There's like three kids over there that are picking flowers. There's a big cluster of kids that are like running around chasing the ball, but they don't really know how to play soccer. They're just like kicking the ball, having a good time. And when you tell them we're going to play soccer, they're pumped. They get their cleats, they put on their shin guards, and they just love the process of it. And you take them home and you're like, buddy, why did we get you into soccer? Because all you did was pick flowers. Like, who cares? You're like, well, it's just there for the snacks. and then if you turn your view over to the parents that are on the side, the parents are insane. They're like, score, crush them, get it. You know, they are, because they're looking for that outcome. They want the score. They know that the score is what matters. And the kids are like, are you kidding me? I got to run around and have a good time. And so as we get older, we often kind of have the process orientation beat out of us, because the adult world is outcome oriented, right? We have our awards and our degrees and our resumes and our jobs and our promotions and our big cars and our big houses and whatever, right? We are looking for the outcome that shows that we are successful, which I think is another reason our culture right now just cannot tolerate failure. We don't know how to survive it. And if you are more on the process orientation, then you are experiencing the actual journey. And I know there's a million catchy quotes and things put on walls and whatever, and enjoy the journey. And I think that that is really great sentiment. I think that very few people are actually able to embrace it. And I think it's said in a very cliche way, because it's unbelievably powerful for us if we can process the process, that we can actually see that we are going through that and we can survive it. It's part of letting that pendulum swing, instead of just thinking that the outcome that I am seeking is to make sure that I only feel happy. Well, that's impossible. So you're set up for failure, but you can't process your failure. So you're kind of doomed. So I think that a lot of that is what happens when parents get overly anxious and concerned for their kids having a hard time, is they're already planning their college graduation and their marriage and their their white picket fence and house, and the kid's just trying to get through, you know, seventh grade algebra.
Right.
Yeah. Like they're working with a teacher that they can't.
Or dealing with their friend that's picking on them or the bully or whatever. Like,
right. You know? Yeah, absolutely. They're just trying to experience this process, and parents are trying to like just spout the most profound information that's just going to, you know, like make their whole world shake. And it's unlikely that you're going to like blow their mind in such a way when really half of the experience that is having a friend who's being mean to you is experience the emotions of that.
Yeah.
It's about being able to figure out how to trust your gut to feel what it feels like to have someone that you can't trust. And so that the next time, right, as I pay attention to the fact that I'm in a process, I'm going to have other friends in the future. I'll have a better sense of who's a good friend to me. And at what point do I, you know, put the brakes on and say, our friendship isn't healthy and it can't continue this way.
Yeah.
But we don't do that. We just want to tell kids, like, you got to be better about picking friends so that you just have the outcome of having always good friends. And that is not how we learned. That's not how we got to our age knowing what we know. We got to our age by living every day and having a couple friends be kind of mean to us.
Yeah, well, and that doesn't teach you how to deal with conflict within your relationships.
Right.
If you're just like, well, just don't be friends with them anymore, or, you know.
And then that gets even more dangerous when we get into things like mental health concerns, because if I am suffering with depression and I'm starting to think about suicide and I'm an adolescent and I know I bring that up to my parents are going to freak out because that doesn't play into the plan of getting you into college,
right?
Like, and parents are just so far off perspective wise because they're so worried about so many things that they can't even really hear their kids. So I think one of the most important things when kids start to bring up really heavy topics, first and foremost, do your homework. You know, mm-hmm. if you're still quoting drug statistics that you learned when you're in high school or that your parents told you that they learned in high school, I mean, you're so far out of the loop. So no matter what the topic is, even if the topic makes you really uncomfortable,
mm-hmm.
do some homework. And I think the second part of that is really just be able to bring the topic up and then shut up and listen. You know, if your kid is having concerns about something, then let them talk about their feelings and let them talk about what all the different questions are and how they've thought it through so far. And, you know, if it's a big topic for them, they've probably just been mulling on it for days and weeks and they have a lot of processing. And if you just go in there looking for the answer and the outcome, you have just essentially told them that you don't care how they feel. You just want them to get it right. You just want the right answer. And that will sort of crush their ability to communicate with you.
Yeah. So again, it comes back to us as parents being able to monitor our own reactions and the own blockages that we've set up. And right. And I love what you're saying about this, the process, because that's, you know, that's a narrative that I just like, this fear of failure, the pressure to perform, you know, those are adult constructs. Those are things that it's like that we impose on our kids and on
right.
our culture and our society. And so it's just, it's kind of tragic. But then you hear these messages that are like, you know, Will Smith being like, here's how you succeed. You got to fail, fail, and then fail some more. And it's like, oh, okay. That makes any sense whatsoever. I can sit at home and do nothing and fail, you know,
right.
but like the message is really, you have to be doing, you have to get out there and experience
doing,
the process. And through those things that you're learning, like failure is labeled as bad. But if you just get rid of that stigma and you say, you know what, failure is just part of the process. Of
right.
what I'm going through, and a growth mindset really comes into play with that. Is that, you know, mm-hmm. people with a growth mindset, they, you know, they look at it as opportunity. They look at challenge as opportunity to learn something and to,
right.
to grow, and to maybe even expose weak spots so that they can work on them.
Yeah, absolutely. I was just listening to this TED Talk, well, re-listening to this TED Talk, and they're talking about how the focus was on change. And how when we look at our future, we say, in the next 10 years, I probably won't change that much. But if we look backwards at the last 10 years, we look at, wow, 10 years. Wow, look at all those things that have happened and all those things that, like, I have changed a lot. And again, our brain sort of gets like pinpointed on the outcome that, like, I feel like at this point I'm pretty fully actualized and this is about as much as I'm going to change, which is ridiculous because they interviewed people at all sorts of 10-year increments. And we always underestimate how much we will change, and we underestimate how much change is still out there for us to accomplish. And so I just think it's the same thing, that we need to have less a sense of like our own outcome, that I'm about as good as I'm going to get. So this is like who I am and this is how I roll. And we're just going to like live with it that way. Like, that is ridiculous. That's not even what life is about. And it's just so inaccurate that I haven't crossed the finish line. Today is the finish line and I've become the person that I'm going to be. That there's sometimes as we get older, we think that we are sort of done, but we're not. They said in the TED Talk that we grow a little bit less as we get older, but it's still so much more than we think we're going to grow in the next 10 years. And so to even just have a better concept of ourselves being in the process and our ability to, teach an old dog new tricks, you know, that even if you have already raised a couple kids and you only have one or two left at home, that you don't just keep doing what you always did, that you can't get better, or they even just sort of kick it in neutral. Because I could tell you, I've worked with, so this is just a little aside, but I have worked with some babies of the family that received no parenting because the parents were done. And I think that is missing the whole point of the fact that we can continue to get better at being ourselves. And that isn't just something that happens to us as kids, as teenagers, as young adults, that even as aging adults, that we continue to grow. And that really allows us, I think, to become that, you know, to live the full life that really we have access to, but we have to take those blocks out. We have to take that baggage and take care of it and not just get used to, well, I've always sort of had this sort of crippling thing and this is just how I am. And this is just as far as my ability manages to go. And I just don't think that that's true.
Yeah. I love that so much. And it's just, there's so much about that, because I think like with the younger kid thing, the blockages in adulthood don't just come from when we were kids or whatever, you know. They're things that are always developing. And I read this quote recently that when you're afraid of change, then you cling to the past. But when you have faith in the future, then you can embrace the change.
Right.
And I think that's such an important coping mechanism that, you know, to be able to just have faith and embrace the opportunity that comes with change and learning from those different situations that we encounter throughout our lives. And I actually had this experience lately, because I was talking to somebody that we know who's a health coach, and she allowed me free coaching, and I was like, sweet. So, 'cause she's learning. And I was talking to her because I was like, oh, I really want to figure out how to manage my energy. And, I hate mornings. I have that narrative. I'm not a morning person. And the story that I always told myself is that it's because when I was in kindergarten, I was a really big pain, and my mom switched me from morning to afternoon. But then as I was talking to this person, I had this realization, because I don't always hate mornings. When I'm up, I love mornings, you know, when it's just waking up that I dread. But anyways, I had this realization though. I was talking to her and I was like, you know what? There are 7 children in my family. That whole story, I was like, I just rewrote it. And I said, my parents were already stressed out, struggling to get 5 other kids out the door, besides my younger brother, that they said, you know what? This is one less thing we have to deal with. We'll just move Jody to the afternoon. And that completely changed my whole narrative of like, I hate mornings. I'm a terrible morning person because since I was a kid.
Right.
And it like completely changed my whole perspective of like, oh, and I look back on times when I really enjoyed being up in the morning or things like that in my life. And, And so it's just interesting that as we get older, we can learn new things. We can experience, reframe those experiences that have created blocks for us,
right,
and address those issues for ourselves and be aware of them and be able to work through them. So that,
we really like to think that we have the answers. Mm-hmm. And so we want to be able to say like, oh, I'm not a morning person, or, oh, I'm an introvert, or, oh, I'm an extrovert. Like, we love to just get a sense of control by clinging to those labels. Mm-hmm. But then that just really kind of makes us cookie cutters, and we try to shove ourselves into places where we don't necessarily fit, and we lose the ability. Like, we want to have other people see us as more than a cookie cutter, but a lot of times we treat ourselves the opposite way, and we want to just find ways to make things easy on ourselves and feel like we know what we're doing and we have the right answers and we're being successful. And I think that that is a lot of it too, just with parenting and being an adult, we're so caught up in the concern over whether or not we're doing a good job. Lots of parents who are just terrified of talking to a therapist because they're really afraid that they're going to find out that they're a terrible parent, which if you are taking your kids to get the help that they need, you're probably doing some major right things already. But it is amazing to me how often I talk to adults who just would rather stick their head in the sand with their little right answers that they think that they already have nailed down, and they don't want to change because what if they get it wrong? And just that fear, especially as a parent, that you're in charge of these little guys, and you want to make sure that you're not screwing them up, and that you're doing a good job. And that is fascinating to me, that people would hold off in seeking help and getting help from a therapist because they don't want someone to say, you're doing a terrible job.
Well, it's self-fulfilling prophecy. It ends up being that you encounter the conflict on the road you're trying to follow to avoid it. And it's like, that to me is so much more tragic than if you just try to, you know, allow yourself to be vulnerable for a little bit, to figure out what's going on and how to grow, how to change, and how to learn and embrace this process. Like, I love that word so much right now. I just, that's something that, you know, in life, we just interpret things as good or bad. And it's just not always that way in the experiences that we have. Like, it's just, you got to look at it as a process of, what is this teaching me? What am I having to go through? And then also just being in this moment, in this process, not so overly anxious about the future or overly regretful of the past, you know, but embracing what's going on right now in this process that we're experiencing right now.
Well, and I think we like to think of ourselves like living in a movie, and I have yet to have the moment where, like, it's freeze frame and they roll the credits, you know, like, I've had successes, but then, you know what? I went to bed that night and got up the next morning and, you know, went back to it. There was no moment where they're just chanting my name and then freeze frame, roll the credits, and I'm done. And I think we really want to have it nice and tidy like that, like we're watching a film, and that isn't. And also, you know, that's entertainment. Nobody watches me do the laundry or do the dishes. Like, that's not entertainment to watch me vacuum, but is that part of everybody's life? Yeah, absolutely. Is that what happens to, like, people who have successes and losses? Yeah, absolutely.
Well, I think of this, and I think of that it's okay not to know. It's okay not to know.
Yeah.
And like you said, parents who feel like, oh, I have to, they speak in definitives, you know, I am this way or I'm that way. Or to say, I have to have the answers, to just say, it's okay. It's okay not to know. It's okay not to know what the answer is. It's okay to sit with the discomfort of a situation that's uncomfortable, and to not know the answer.
So, well, and I feel like that's another one of the things that I hear parents say. They'll say that to their kids, but then their actions don't match it too. I think it falls right into the, like, it's a safe space category where we sort of claim things. And I think that that is another place where, if you want your kids to communicate well with you, it is important for you to be more reflective, you know, in the middle of a conversation, pause and think, am I actually letting this, am I listening? Am I just listening to respond? Am I listening to understand? And am I listening in a way that is engaging in the process of me communicating with my child versus me having the right answer versus me knowing, looking like a parent who knows what they're talking about? You know, there's so much concern about making sure that you have got it right and you have the answers. And how powerful is that for us to have authority figures like parents say, that is a really good question. You know what? I think maybe we could both take a couple of days and think about this and maybe read a couple of things and study and kind of meditate on it and come back together and see what we find out. How powerful is that for kids to not think that our either, you know, little kids think the parents know everything, but then as you get older, it turns the opposite way. And how about you just kind of balance that a little bit more in acknowledging, yeah, I don't know what the right thing is to do in this moment. And what if we work on this together? That is the kind of communication that you want to have with your children when you are talking about really difficult topics, whether they be mental health concerns, whether they be just your kid has made some really bad decisions and now how do we regroup? How do we clean it up? And not have it be a moment where you are just afraid and ashamed that, if I was a better parent, my kid would have never done that. Right. Or this is going to ruin my kid's chance to get into college or whatever. And I just need to go clean up. And you just sit over there and wallow and think about how terrible you are while I fix your problem. Like there's so many extremes for bad ways to handle that. And finding ways to join kids in the process of figuring it out rather than just swooping in like the hero with all the answers because you are so focused on the outcome and have, you know, and being smart and having the control and not have to sit in the fear of not knowing.
Yeah. Or that something is going against what you thought you believed about yourself or your child.
Right.
Yeah. Awesome. Caitlin, I love this conversation so much. And I think I could just talk to you all day.
Absolutely.
But in conclusion, I'd like to ask you, what are some books on this topic that you like to recommend for parents?
That is a really great question. I tend to read some books, I'm definitely biased because anything by Brené Brown, I love, but she's also an LCSW like me and a social worker. So if you haven't seen her TED Talk, watch her both TED Talks, read her books. And she does a really nice job of helping people understand their own sense of shame and all these emotions. In her TED Talk, she talks about the pendulum and wanting to put all her feelings in little bento boxes. And so I really love that idea. And a lot of her books have followed the same thing. But I also think that a lot of what I have learned on this concept too has come from articles and other podcasts, and sometimes it can just be fiction and other books and people that are writing poems and short stories. And I just think there's a lot of places where if we pay attention, sometimes the more academic feeling books just make us feel like we need to make a list so that we have the right outcome. And sometimes we just need to read a story that is mixed with humor and pain. And you're like, oh yeah, I need to enjoy the journey. So I definitely would say there's a mixture of all those things that are in there. And, sometimes it's things that I think about when I am riding my bike for hours and just little pieces of that will roll through my head and let me sort of meditate on it. So my short answer is anything by Brené Brown. My long answer is stuff that inspires you and that you love and makes you sort of stretch your thinking. I would encourage people to read books or seek out podcasts that aren't necessarily supporting something that they already know, but stretching them. I think a lot of times in politics, people only read things that support the opinion they already have. And I think that can happen with parenting and relationships too, is I find people who are just going to tell me that I'm already doing it right and we don't get a better understanding of the other side. So even you don't have to change your mind. You just need to know what's on the other side.
I love that so much. Thank you, Caitlin. I love that so much. I really appreciate that perspective. And I've had a guest on talking about the power of stories and about, and how it's so important to be able to be open-minded. And it's just, I can see how those things really would benefit being able to just be open to talk about these difficult conversations, be willing to be open to our own, addressing our own blocks in our pendulum and things like that. So I really, really appreciate that. Thank you.
You bet.
So awesome. Thank you again for listening. This has been a great experience that I've had with Kaylin. I'm so grateful that I get to share it with you. And I want to share the full 2 hour, the second half of this episode at www.ourmodernheritage.com/episode074. And you can check out the rest of our conversation. It's just, there's so much here. And Kaylin is just full of wonderful information. So make sure you go check that out. Thank you again for listening. Be sure to head over to my website for the show notes. And that website is homeandfamilyculture.com. And follow me on Instagram at Family Culture Podcast. And keep in mind this quote from Mother Teresa: if you want to change the world, go home and love your family.